The headlines: pro-Russia officials evacuate Kherson amid escalating pressure from a Ukrainian counter-offensive. Hamas calls for international condemnation and prosecution of Israel following the arrest of the regime's spies in Malaysia for kidnapping a Palestinian activist. And also in our headlines, Mali warns it will exercise its right to self-defense if France continues to undermine a West African country's sovereignty. Hello and welcome, everybody. Citizens and pro-Russia officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. The leader of Kherson says the entire administration is moving to the left bank of the Dnieper River. Still, he's pledging that Russian forces will fight to the death to defend the region. According to the official, over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. And earlier, the commander of Russian forces in Ukraine described the military situation as tense and difficult around Kherson. Sergei Sorovkin said Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings. Last month, President Vladimir Putin announced the annexation of Kherson and three other Ukrainian regions. Moscow said people in those provinces had shown overwhelming support to join Russia in referendums. In yet another hostile move, the European Union has imposed sanctions on over a dozen Iranian officials and entities. That's over the accusation that Iran violated human rights while dealing with recent riots and vandalism there. In December 2020, the bloc adopted a policy to address serious rights violations and abuses worldwide. However, to do so, the EU would crucially need to comply with human rights itself.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless.
The EU claims its anti-Iran sanctions are in response to what it calls crackdown on peaceful protests. Iranian officials say those who are responsible for vandalism, death, and rioting cannot be categorized as peaceful protesters. Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of European governments' widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries.
The US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, it's part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflicts. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli regime is conducting, quote, systematic terrorism by targeting Palestinians across the globe. Hamas called for international condemnation and prosecution of Israel for its attacks on Palestinians abroad. This after Malaysian officials said they arrested Israeli spies for kidnapping a Palestinian activist. Hamas also praised the Malaysian government for the release of the abducted Palestinian. The resistance movement said that the Mossad has violated Malaysia's sovereignty. On Tuesday, Malaysia reported the arrest of citizens who were recruited and trained by the Mossad to capture, interrogate, and torture the Palestinian. Earlier, we were joined by international lawyer Barry Grosson to get his thoughts on the Israeli operation. He says the regime uses tactics such as intimidation and espionage to pursue its goals abroad.
Well, look, the actual event itself comes as no surprise. It's no secret that the occupation, more generally, and Mossad specifically, have long used tactics of intimidation, coercion, enticement, espionage, and ultimately assassination in order to promote their priorities abroad. Books have been written about it. Books have been written about it by Israeli citizens. So there's nothing surprising about that. Those of us who support the Palestinian cause have long been aware of this, and this latest turn of events fits that MO perfectly. What is interesting is to see in very stark terms not only this unfold in Malaysia, but to hear that the occupation and Mossad have been training, recruiting and training Malaysian citizens in Europe in order to do their wet work back home in Malaysia. And of course, the call for those responsible to be prosecuted is well made, but unfortunately at the international level, there really is no appropriate forum, no forum with jurisdiction to do that very effectively.
Well, tensions between Mali and France are escalating, with Bamako accusing Paris of undermining the West African country's sovereignty and national security. In this segment of the program, Mali says it would exercise its right to self-defense if France continued to undermine the West African country's sovereignty and national security. Malian foreign minister said France had violated his country's airspace and delivered arms to militants that have been engaged in an offensive in northern Mali for the past decade. Speaking at the United Nations, Abdoulaye Diop underlined the need for a Security Council meeting to investigate evidence regarding acts of espionage waged by France. Relations between France and Mali have soured since an August 2020 coup. Paris says it's withdrawing troops which were sent to Mali in 2013. France claims the troops were in Mali to help rid the country of insurgency. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have publisher of Africa Briefing, Mr. Jonathan Ofeansa, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, we have political analyst Julius Mbaluto, who's joining us from Nairobi. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ofeansa in London. Let's get to the core of this issue. What is France doing in Mali?
Well, France originally went to Mali at the invitation of the previous civilian government, you know, to help fight the jihadist insurgencies, right? And since this current military government took power 2 years ago, they've had some problems. So what happened was this current military government asked France to pull out its troops because it was not happy with certain activities, you know, by the French forces. So the French reluctantly had to leave Mali. Look, and as we all know, you know, French, you know, has a very long relationship with its former colonies. It still treats its former colonies, you know, as part of France, and tries to exert certain level of political and economic control over those colonies. So my reading is France is not happy. Mali is trying to assert its sovereignty. Its troops have been asked to leave the country, so it will resort. It's a typical Western destabilization tactic that, you know, I believe France is resorting to, because I'm not sure that this current military government in Mali would just get up and fabricate stories against France just for the sake, for the mere sake of it.
Julius Mbaluto, Malian foreign minister, has said that France had violated his country's airspace, and this is a part we're highlighting, delivered arms to militants that have been engaged in an offensive in northern Mali for the past decade. Walk us through the recent comments by the Malian foreign minister, and also what is France gaining in this scenario that was mentioned by delivering arms to militants in the north of Mali for the past decade or so?
Well, the desire for Malian people, for French forces to leave their country, is not new. It's been there for a very long time. And of course, the climax was when we saw the French forces deciding to leave Mali, in which case it could have been like a closure. But when you look at what happened now, and you get to understand why Malian people see this as espionage, because the French are supposed to have left Mali. The French soldiers are supposed to have also left the country. Yet you see a situation whereby, according to the allegation, they are coming back supporting one group within the Mali territory, which again is not what the transitional government wants to see. Transitional government of Mali have rules. And by the way, if you check, for example, MINUSC, the peacekeepers from United Nations, they have not been spared. They have been restricted. There are restrictions for them. They cannot operate fully within the Malian territory. Look at also in terms of United Nations forces also, and other governments or any other country. Malian transitional government has put in rules of engagement. Their airspace is not open for everyone. They're not giving visas for even international organizations like even United Nations, which means, of course, then they are enforcing their sovereignty. Also, it's like a zero tolerance to interference, of which, of course, they see France as one of the greatest offender, because France, of course, because of the historical colonial link, there's been bad blood between the Malian transition of government and also the French government as well. So we see a situation whereby Malians see France as a former colony. They see them as a power that should not be operational in their country. They see them that way. And France said, okay, we're going to pull up. So it's like, what are you doing? And it's actually worse when they hear French can support an insurgent group within their territory.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jonathan Ofe, UNSUP publisher at Africa Briefing, joining us from London. And also thanks to political analyst Julius Mbaluto, joining us from Nairobi. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. See you in a bit. Well, North Korea says that it fired artillery shells toward its east and west coasts in a grave warning to South Korea. Pyongyang says, quote, enemies should immediately stop provocative actions that caused military tension. According to the South Korean military, Pyongyang fired some 250 shells into the sea. North Korea's latest military activity comes just a day after the South kicked off its annual Hoguk defense drills. Seoul says the joint maneuvers are aimed at boosting the ability of its troops to counter North Korea's nuclear threats. Pyongyang says the drills are a rehearsal for invasion. North Korea has repeatedly reacted by launching long and short-range missiles. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. Senior Hezbollah officials say Lebanon's firm position and the resistance movement's efforts help the country safeguard its maritime rights. In indirect talks with the Israeli regime and eventually forced the Zionist enemy to retreat. They were reacting to a draft agreement reached between Lebanon and the Zionist regime that would potentially end a long-running maritime border dispute in the gas-rich Mediterranean Sea. We've taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Fast News Agency writes, Lebanon has approved a maritime border deal with Israel, which President Michel Aoun, stressing that the country has recovered a large swathe of its territory without even conceding a single square kilometer to the Zionist regime. The Lebanese President Michel Aoun said in a televised speech on Thursday, 13th of October, I announced the approval by Lebanon of the final version prepared by the American mediator to delineate the southern maritime border. Michel Aoun described the deal as a historic achievement and said Lebanon was able to recover a disputed area of 860 square kilometers. He said Lebanon did not concede a single square kilometer to Israel, adding that his country had seized full control over the Qanar field. Michel Aoun said, This indirect agreement responds to the Lebanese claims and fully preserves our rights, stressing that no normalization with Israel took place and no direct talks or agreements were held with it. The announcement came a day after the Israeli regime's cabinet approved by majority the formula for the maritime border demarcation agreement with Lebanon. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, said on Tuesday, 11th of October, that the movement will not recognize any maritime border deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime until it is officially signed. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said, We will remain vigilant until such a deal is finalized, noting a proper deal should meet the Lebanese government's demands. A senior Hezbollah lawmaker also said, Lebanon's firm position and the resistance movement's efforts had helped the country safeguard its maritime rights in indirect talks with the Israeli regime and eventually forced the Zionist enemy to retreat. Lebanon and the Israeli regime carried out five sessions of indirect talks on the demarcation of maritime borders starting in 2020, with the latest round of talks being held in May of 2021. Since the negotiations kicked off, Hezbollah declared that the extraction of gas from Karish gas field without guarantees to Lebanon that it will be able to explore and extract its maritime resources is a red line. Lebanon's Al-Manar News Network explains more about the same story. A top official of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, said Beirut has achieved its goals in the maritime dispute case with the Israeli regime without resorting to military action. The head of Hezbollah's political council, Ebrahim Amin al-Sayed, said on Saturday, 15th of October, that there is a generation in Lebanon that has crushed the power of the arrogant countries and foiled their wars against Lebanon. Ebrahim Amin al-Sayed said, Lebanon, thanks to the resistance and the unified national stance, has won in the case of its maritime wealth without needing to go to war to achieve this. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati also said, the unified Lebanese stance and the country's adherence to its rights and demands have led to this positive outcome. Mirati made the statement as he received a copy of the final draft of the maritime border demarcation deal with the Israeli regime during his meeting with Parliament Deputy Speaker Elias Bou Saab. The Lebanese Premier said He asked French company Total Energy to begin gas exploration in the country's territorial waters. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 11th of October, that Lebanon and Israel agreed to formally end their maritime border dispute and were ready to take the next steps. The Israeli regime's cabinet approved the deal on Wednesday, 12th of October, by a large majority. The agreement will be forwarded to the Israeli regime parliament, the Knesset, for a two-week review before a final cabinet vote. Moreover, Lebanon's private LBCI television network reports. A senior Lebanese politician says his country's demands have been met during indirect negotiations on a maritime border demarcation deal with the Israeli regime, emphasizing that the Hezbollah resistance movement imposed the equation of power on the Tel Aviv regime in this case. The leader of the Free Patriotic Movement of Lebanon, Gibran Barcel, said, Hezbollah imposed the equation of power and Lebanon obtained its demand in the course of talks about maritime border demarcation with Israel. The prominent Christian politician said he had earlier stated that the natural gas must be extracted from both the Karish gas field in the eastern Mediterranean Sea and the Qana gas field. He declared none will be extracted without the other. Gibran Barcel said, It was the resistance front which drew up to impose and imposed the equation of power on the Israeli regime. This manifestly shows how beneficial Hezbollah is for Lebanon. Shouldn't we make use of such a capacity? After submitting the final draft of the deal to President Michel Aoun, Lebanon's negotiator Elias Boussav said, Lebanon has obtained its full rights and all of its remarks have been taken into account. He added that the final draft takes into consideration all of Lebanon's requirements and we believe that the other side should feel the same. Michel Aoun had previously said that a deal would not signify a partnership with the Israeli regime as the two sides are technically at war. In February of 2018, Lebanon signed its first contract for drilling in two blocks in the Mediterranean Sea with a consortium comprising of energy giants Total, Eni and Novatek. Lebanon and the Israeli regime took part in indirect talks to discuss demarcation in 2020. But the talks stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, which the Israeli regime had given exploration rights to a Greek firm. According to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011, the talks were supposed to discuss a Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers, more further south, including part of the Karish gas field.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar. a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood. And we are presently discussing on an important question, which is that why did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala send the messengers? Rather, what was the social circumstance and what are those conditions of the society that were the reason behind the prophets being sent to them? What was the problem with the community? Like, what need did the community have that the prophets came? So one of them was that we discussed previously, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Wa ahwa'un muntashira." At that time, the communities were polarized, or people were, you know, based on certain caste systems. There were classes between them, and, you know, the higher class, the lower class, based on race, based on gender, based on many things, based on, for example, you can say power, authority, and different ways people divided themselves, and, you know, the economic situations and all that. We discussed about it in the previous session. Today we're going to discuss another phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَطَرَائِقُ مُتَشَتِّتَ, that these societies had different, the human society was like, they had different paths. People were following their own paths. They had different ways of what they how they wanted to, you know, be, and what they wanted to do, let's say, as a community, as a society. Where now he explains, وَطَرَائِقُ مُتَشَتِّتَةٌ بَيْنَ مُشَبِّهٍ لِلَّهِ. Now, when we talk about these different ways of being in the community, these different, you can say, styles of living, these different styles of thinking and perceiving, وَطَرَائِقُ مُتَشَتِّتَةٌ. Now he explains that, بَيْنَ مُشَبِّهٍ لِلَّهِ بِخَلْقِهِ أَوْ مُلْحِدٍ فِي إِسْمِهِ أَوْ مُشِيرٍ إِلَى غَيْرِهِ. Inshallah, we will discuss about this in the coming segment.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We said that Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to give us an understanding about the conditions that were ripe for the coming of the messengers. And one of those was that communities were divided into different paths. طَرَائِقُ مُتَشَتِّتَ. They were in different paths. What type of paths were these? بَيْنَ مُشَبِّهٍ لِلَّهِ. There was one group of people, when they wanted to understand God, they compared God بِخَلْقِهِ to His creation. So, you know, in the society, people started to, for example, take a cow as God. For example, sometimes some people take different things as God, the wind as God, let's say the mountain, a certain mountain as God. Sometimes some people take human beings as God, a human being, specifically maybe a very strong human being or a very, you know, some kind of human being that has some level of perfections maybe materially, and then they would worship that entity, like the Pharaoh, let's say, and the different types of people at that time in the previous generations, the emperors, let's say, they would be taken as gods sometimes. So بين مشبه لله بخلقه. Sometimes they would compare, an entity to God. They would say, for example, a certain entity that is his creation, but they would compare it to God, rather even call it God. أو ملحد في اسمه. Another group of people would be those that were ملحد في اسمه. That means they were such that they focused, their focus was mostly in the name of God, in the concept, in developing the concept of God, but they did not go further than that to understand who God is and what his essence is in reality. So this was another group of people that inshallah we shall discuss about very shortly.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. You're talking about the fact that people of the world were divided in terms of their understanding of God. Some of them, they compared God to his creation in such a way that they even, said some entities of the world to be God. Another group of people, they were such that أو ملحدين في اسمه, they were confined to the name of God. ملحدين في اسمه means they were confined to the name of God. They were so much focused on the name of God that they disbelieved in God himself. Now, what does that mean? Inshallah, I'll open up slowly what that means. See, human beings know about God. They have an understanding about God, a natural, affinity towards God, and therefore a very, very innate understanding about who God is. And that is there inside everyone, ingrained within everyone's nature. But that needs to be developed using the intellect and to understand who that God is. Now, what people do, unfortunately, is that when they go into the direction of understanding God, they start to develop a certain concept about God. And then after developing that concept about God, they do not go any further to understand how their relationship with this God has to be. Sometimes the concept that they build about God is a wrong concept of God. And all of these mean that these people, at the end of the day, they end up not really adhering to that God, to that belief that they have about God. And they end up not really having that strong or the real belief. This is a very deep concept that needs a very strong understanding, inshallah. We shall discuss about it in the coming sessions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
مرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The British government has spent the past few weeks turning announcements about taxation and spending into moments of political theatre. On 23rd of September, a fiscal event dubbed the mini-budget introduced the largest package of tax cuts in half a century. A medium-term fiscal plan eventually scheduled for 31st of October was to set out the more trivial details, like how it would be paid for. On 17th of October, Jeremy Hunt, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, cancelled £32 billion of those tax cuts, ripping up virtually the whole of the mini-budget. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Jeremy Hunt has shredded Liz Truss's economic plans in one of the most astonishing U-turns in modern political history, including slashing the energy price freeze, which the Prime Minister had repeatedly championed. The new Chancellor of the Exchequer dismantled almost all of the platform that Liz Truss's leadership victory had been built on, including the majority of her tax cuts, and hinted a new windfall tax was in his sights, a move that the Prime Minister had previously said she would not countenance. Jeremy Hunt also refused to rule out cuts to totemic Conservative pledges, including defence spending and the pensions triple lock. Liz Truss declined to appear at the dispatch box in Parliament on Monday, 17th of October, despite calls from Labour, leading one cabinet minister to clarify that she was not hiding under a desk. In an interview with the BBC on Monday night, she said she wanted to accept responsibility and say sorry for the mistakes that have been made. "I wanted to act to help people with their energy bills and to deal with the issue of high taxes, but we went too far and too fast," she said. With her premiership in grave doubt, sources at No. 10 Downing Street told The Guardian that Liz Truss met Sir Graham Brady, the powerful chair of the 1922 committee, where they discussed the scale of Conservative MPs' anger. A new poll from Redfield and Wilton gave Labour a 36-point lead, the largest for any political party from any polling company since October of 1997. In a statement on Monday morning, Jeremy Hunt said the 20p basic tax rate would remain indefinitely and reversed a swathe of other tax measures, including changes to dividend taxes, a VAT-free shopping scheme, and a freeze on some alcohol duties. But the biggest shock came when the Chancellor said he would no longer guarantee energy prices for the next two winters, and that more targeted measures would replace the universal guarantee from next spring after a Treasury review. It means the average annual energy bill will rise to more than £4,000 from April. According to the sector's leading forecaster, and analysts say it could lead to a rise of almost 5 percentage points in the annual inflation rate. Inflation currently stands at 9.9%, and is expected to rise slightly when the figure for September is announced on Tuesday. The Institute for Fiscal Studies said the £32 billion tax increases, the biggest since 1993, would not be enough on their own to undo the damage caused by the debacle of the past few weeks. Paul Johnson, the think tank's director, said the Chancellor's decision to scrap most of the tax cuts announced last month was welcome, but would not be enough to plug the gap in the government's fiscal plans. Jeremy Hunt will use his next fiscal statement, due on 31st of October, to outline how the government intends to reduce public sector debt as a share of national income over time. Estimates of what it would take to achieve this range between £60 billion and £72 billion. The only key tax announcement to survive were the cancellation of the national insurance rise and stamp duty changes, both already subject to new legislation. Jeremy Hunt refused to rule out changes to the pensions triple lock and said a new windfall tax on energy profits was on the table. "I'm not against the principle of taxing profits that are genuine windfalls," he told the House of Commons. Few in Westminster believe Liz Truss's premiership is secure even with the significant reversals. One member of the 1922 executive said the group could take action this week, either by changing the rules or sending Sir Graham Brady to tell Liz Truss it was over. "When the herd moves," they said. The Economist magazine gives us more details about the same story. Jeremy Hunt was rushing to calm financial markets that his predecessor as Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, had well and truly spooked. Britain's currency and its government debt or gilts cratered in the wake of growth plan that Mr. Kwarteng laid out on 23rd of September. The gilt sell-off was so sharp that it forced some pension funds into fire sales, creating a self-reinforcing feedback loop and threatening financial instability. An emergency bond-buying program from the Bank of England, along with Mr. Kwarteng's defenestration, went some way to restoring order. But as the central bank's intervention came to an end on 14th of October, gilt yields, which move inversely to prices, were rising ominously once again. Jeremy Hunt's statement today was designed to reassure the markets once and for all that the government is fully committed to fiscal responsibility. It has brought some much-needed breathing space. The 30-year gilt yield, which breached 4.8% on Friday, fell back to 4.4%. The pound, worth less than $1.12 on Friday, rose to around $1.14. But the price of all this has been the wholesale destruction of the tax-cutting agenda that brought Liz Truss to power. She had already announced the reinstatement of a corporation tax rise she had previously promised to scrap, and before that, reversed the move to abolish the top rate of income tax. In addition, Jeremy Hunt today cancelled promised cuts to the basic rate of income tax and the dividend tax rate, as well as a planned freeze on alcohol duty rates and a VAT-free shopping scheme for visitors to Britain. A cut to national insurance, a payroll tax, remains, for now at least. So does a small cut to stamp duty, a tax on property transactions, as well as some other bits and pieces. But Liz Truss's economic programme is virtually dead. So is the philosophy that underpinned it, that tax cuts could pay for themselves by stimulating economic growth. The wing of the Conservative Party that advocates sound money is firmly in the ascendancy. But more pain is to come. Jeremy Hunt also promised a review of the blank cheque the government signed in offering to protect households and businesses from higher energy costs, aiming to make it more targeted and less expensive after April of 2023. Prior to his statements, Britain's public finances faced a hole in the medium term, reported to be around £70 billion per year. Taken together, the Chancellor's announcements may take the shortfall down to around £40 billion. Jeremy Hunt warned of difficult decisions ahead. Mr. Hunt's extraordinary elevation has been as striking as Liz Truss's political implosion after two unsuccessful tilts at the party leadership. Until a fortnight ago, Jeremy Hunt's career in high office seemed to be over. He finished second behind Boris Johnson in the Conservative Party's leadership contest in 2019. In the contest of 2022, he gathered the support of just 18 MPs. His background as a Remainer made him an unlikely fit for a party that has become more dogmatic since the Brexit referendum of 2016. Now he is the Prime Minister in all but name. Yet even he is not really in charge. For the foreseeable future, Britain's fiscal policy will be dictated not by what its politicians want, but rather by what the bond markets will bear.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and profound hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Qadim alayhi salam, This hadith is about the knowledge of God. You know, the knowledge of God is one of those subjects which is very tricky, very difficult to understand, and it's something that has been a subject of debate amongst philosophers, amongst theologians, from times immemorial, from a long time ago. And the difficulty of this subject is something that's related to all of its aspects, different aspects. For example, how can God know things before they are created? You know, so God's pre-knowledge. Then there's the question of whether God's knowledge, what is the nature of this knowledge? Is it, you know, is it in the form of images, like our knowledges, or is it something very direct and intuitive? You know, so there's various aspects to this discussion. Each of them, you know, should be discussed and should be investigated separately and obviously in its own proper place. We don't want to go into the, you know, the details of this discussion. But in this beautiful hadith, the Imam, alayhi salam, he alludes to one of the aspects of this discussion, or a few of them actually. Let's go slowly and let's look at the various aspects of this discussion, of this hadith, and what it alludes to. Imam Qadhim alayhi salam said, "The knowledge of Allah cannot be defined by where." So in this part of this hadith, the Imam alludes to the fact that this knowledge is not something physical. It's not in a certain place. It's something immaterial. Then the Imam says, "Nor can Allah's knowledge be described by how." وَلَا يُوسَفُ الْإِلْمِ مِنَ اللَّهِ بِكَيْفِ. Right? Cannot be described by how. You cannot describe it by a certain quality. And, it's not a quality of God. It's not like a quality of God. Perhaps this is an allusion to the fact that God's knowledge is not like a property that exists in outside of his essence, but as an attribute of his essence. Right? Like, for example, certain conditions that we undergo, you know, are qualities or properties of us. Or like, for example, like the color of a physical body is the property of that body, right? Like, for example, you say that this apple, how is it? You say it's red, right? God's knowledge cannot be described in such a way. It cannot be said to be similar to this, the redness or the color of this apple. Why? Because this color is something outside of his, of the existence of the apple, whereas God's knowledge, which is his attribute, is united with him. Perhaps this is why, in continuation, the Imam says, Allah's knowledge cannot be separated from him. لا يفرد الإلم من الله. Right? Nor can Allah be distinguished from it, vice versa. Right? They're one with one another. And finally, the Imam says, and there's no barrier between Allah and his knowledge. Right? So this reinforces what we just said, that this knowledge is not like the color of a body. It's not a property which is extraneous to him. It's not a quality that inheres within him. Rather, it's one with his existence. It's united with him and it's identical with his essence. Right? Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the beauty of the knowledge of Allah in the words of Imam Qadhim alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.